Hi, everyone. Good evening. It is Thursday, November 29, 2018. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Most of this was written by Dr. Jay Huffine. He's our clinical director at our Cascades program, and his population or group tends to have these kinds of issues. So it's something that he's worked with and thought of for some time, for several years, for as long as internet and gaming addiction and computer addiction have been relevant. Before that time, it wasn't like the people that he was treating didn't have the same underlying issues, but they just weren't manifested in computer and internet addiction. So I'm going to talk about what it is a little bit. I'm going to visit on the topic of internet and computer addiction, but I'm really going to talk about what's underneath it and what we think about when we treat it. Just prior to having all you folks join in the room, Alex, my moderator, and I were chatting back and forth about how this new screen time app that Apple has put out makes you aware of how much time in a day, on average, you're spending with your compute with your smartphone open and looking at it. And it really, I said to him at one point, one of the weeks that I looked at it was really alarming to me, surprising how much. So I think all of us can relate to it somewhat. All of us can relate to how it can become a distraction, how it can become an escape, how it can take us out of our present feeling and where we are and take us to some kind of fantasy world. So I think that's important to as we think about treating and responding and intervening with our children, that we do it, and we do it courageously, but we also do it with compassion and non-judgment. So with that, let's get started. You know, when I was younger, it was television and telephones. And now, you know, we talk about television a little bit, but more often we're talking about streaming through some kind of device, you know, watching Netflix, watching Hulu, watching things that way. Again, it's very different. I think quantitatively, our ability to access information and distractions has multiplied many, many fold since we were young. So it just becomes that much easier to find some kind of escape. I've commented to my children many times when we're searching for a show to watch, saying, really, we virtually have nearly everything we can possibly imagine at our fingertips. Our phones, you know, even prior to pressing record on this, I was checking my social media while I was sitting here. So our phones can be something that we obsess about and with. And we talk about this in our family. I talk about this with parents. It's important, and you get to decide the numbers and the hours, but it is important for some time each day for everybody to be committed to, dedicated to, not looking at the screen, whether that's meals or sometime in the evening, that you don't completely abandon the idea of being present with yourself and present with each other. Video games, I'm going to speak about that a little bit because that oftentimes leads to the need for treatment and intervention. You know, video games can be the thing that actually poses some of the greatest threat to our children's physical health, not let alone mental health. It can be very addictive. The internet, you know, being in front of a computer all the time. I think one of the challenges with a lot of these things tonight, different than, say, drugs, is that most of us can't not do some of these things. We have to be on the computer. Your children are going to have to be on the computer. We use our phone as a tool, even our social media as a tool sometimes for advertising, marketing, for producing content. And so like food or sex, it's the answer when there's an addiction isn't simply abstinence, right? It becomes more challenging in that one way than something you can completely abstain from. Any kind of instant messaging or text messaging can become addictive. My children will call me on that often because I make myself available to employees and clients sometimes all the time every day, and I have to, like them, I have to set things down. Facebook, social media, Twitter, Instagram, all of those things. I didn't list all of them there. One of the things I'll talk about a little bit about is multiplayer online role-playing games. These are games where you have a subscription and you play with other people, avatars of other people. And there are various ones that are out there over the years. Some of them have become very, very famous in their ability to hook people into addictive patterns. I'll talk about it a little bit later, but these folks have consulted with the gambling industry to try to include elements that lead to addiction, elements that lead to compulsory use beyond anything reasonable. So what do these kinds of things do for our children and for any of us? They put us at greater risk for mood disorders. There's plenty of research now that being online, looking at, immersing oneself in social media puts teens and older people at risk for mood disorders, depression, anxiety. For teens, there's a special risk for eating disorders, right? Body image. I was thinking about this today when I was refreshing some of these slides, that when we were younger, those things still existed in the media, right? We would see commercials, magazines, but now we're carrying around a supercomputer in our pocket that's bombarding us with images. And not just from marketing companies, but from anybody in the world virtually that has access to it. So we're getting messages about how to be, how to look. We're comparing ourselves to other people. And those are some of the difficulties that they're noticing with teenager development these days. Some studies have linked the participation in these computer, internet, social media sites as leading to suicide. I know personally of people who the precipitating event that led to a suicide attempt was something that had to do with social media. Some messages, some bullying, there are those messages and stories in the news often. It makes us vulnerable to bullying, to cyberbullying, right? Because again, it's anonymous. It's hidden behind a screen and a screen name. So people are emboldened to bully. The idea, there's a lot of talk about looking for likes, right? The addiction to likes, and that when you see something that you post that gets a lot of likes, it creates a chemical reaction in your brain that triggers the reward system of the brain, same way that drugs or sex or other highly addictive things do. Like I talked about earlier, comparisons. And again, most of this is fairly common sense, but what we're seeing now is that a lot of the research is backing it up. And then the social skills get impaired. You know, having a difficulty or a deficit in social skills makes you vulnerable to these online communities and multiplayer online role-playing games. Because again, you can hide behind an avatar, a character, somebody that has qualities that you don't think you yourself have. And your interactions become stilted and two-dimensional. So you don't have to develop the same kind of problem-solving skills and social skills that you do in face-to-face interactions. A lot of the research shows that. I have here an image that we think about, maybe a caricature of somebody who's addicted, right? This is Robert. Robert has a serious dependency. It's affecting his ability to function, failing grades, creating major family problems, stealing to support his habit, withdrawing from friends, continues to use despite serious problems that it's causing, has an arrested development in many areas, physical, emotional, social, and academic. And we can also look at this Robert. Or Tommy, I'm sorry. Tommy. Tommy's addicted to multiplayer online role-playing games. A serious dependency, ability to function is impaired, hasn't been in school for 6 months, failing grades, major family problems and conflicts, stealing to support his habit, complete social isolation, and continues to use this despite serious problems, and also has arrested development, physical, emotional, social, academic. So just to illustrate that when we think about addiction, whether it be a process addiction or whether it be something like some substance addiction. We don't distinguish in many ways the potential harm and the root causes of those addictions. And so I say this all the time, that after a few weeks working with a client, maybe 4 or 5 weeks working with a client, so much of it sounds the same. Sometimes I forget the details, the small brushstrokes of the history of a client, their drug of choice, maybe even the precipitating event, the details at least of the precipitating event or events that led to enrollment. Because what we're doing is we're drilling down beneath those layers to look at what's making them vulnerable to this addiction, this compulsion, this self-medicating, this escapism. And of course, there's cross-addiction, right? People that have a susceptibility to process addictions, like internet gaming addictions, also have a susceptibility to substance abuse addiction, substance use addiction. So there's crossover there. For, you know, one of the characteristics is somebody who has to play all the time. And this is something that is said with somebody with a substance abuse disorder and somebody with a process addiction like internet or gaming addiction. This phrase, "I can stop whenever I want to, I just don't want to." It becomes an obsession, right? They begin to become very agitated when they are prevented and escalate and become very aggressive when they are prevented from being able to play. Of course, it creates family problems. One of the earliest ones that we treated for a long time was World of Warcraft. So why are these games so addictive? They're often created, like I said, in consultations with experts in the gaming industry. You talk about the amount of screen time, getting reward for it, increasing in power, right? It's this reward system that they create, that the more time, the more you put into it, the more powerful that you get, the extra perks that you get. You create a character that compensates for a sense of powerlessness, alienation, and insecurities. And again, I'm talking about gaming specifically on the internet, but this can also apply to other things that we do on the internet. The character that we portray, the character that our children portray in their social media. You develop relationships with other online players and can type on the screen to communicate with your friends, and those are in quotes, of course. You gain power and climb up levels by the amount of hours that you spend playing online. So this intermittent reinforcement tends to lead to that addiction, that if you are removed from it, it feels like a physical withdrawal. You become a powerful character. You become almost invincible. You gain a sense of power, a sense of competence and mastery, and a sense of belonging and pride. So again, it seeks to give you a pseudo sense of all these things that are genuine human needs, right? Again, it goes back to everything that we talk about at Evoke. This idea that no matter what the behavior, that somewhere a layer or two or more deep, we can tie that to what are the needs that you're not getting met or you're finding difficult to be met. That is why the Just Say No campaigns don't work. That is why we don't simply pay attention to cessation of behavior, to behavioral change. And then when our clients or our students or your children talk about what they are or aren't going to do, that you don't become impressed with it. And that we lean into assignments like the war story assignments or the purpose of destructive behaviors assignments, assignments that say, this is why I was doing it. This is what I loved about it. One of the most unenlightened things that I have clients say to me in their early weeks of the program is, yeah, I was smoking a lot of pot or I was doing this or that and I didn't like it. And my response is that that's not how it works. We don't keep doing something that doesn't somehow give us something important, especially when it creates a great risk and especially when it creates a lot of conflict or consequences in our life. So we look for what are the needs and we validate those. Still setting the boundaries, still intervening. Here's a study that Dr. Huffine shared with us. The aim of this study was to identify the neural substrates of online gaming addiction through evaluation of the brain areas associated with the cue-induced gaming urge, that trigger to want to do it. The results demonstrate that the neural substrates of cue-induced gaming urge, craving, and online gaming addiction is similar to the cue-induced craving of a substance dependence. The same areas of the brain are triggered and functioning. The above-mentioned brain regions have been reported to contribute to the craving and substance dependence, and here we show that the same areas were involved in online gaming, the urge and the craving for online gaming. Thus, the study concludes, the results suggest that the gaming urge craving and online gaming addiction and craving and substance dependence might share the same neurobiological mechanism. I don't think that surprises most of us. But I think what it can illustrate or illuminate for us is the illusion that sometimes I hear people talk about in all areas of life, the therapeutic field, the addiction field, parental groups, lay people, that there's something different about a drug addict versus somebody that's struggling in another area, a mental health area, or even a process addiction. Our brain science is telling us that they might be the same things, that the preference might not be the same, meaning that it looks different on the surface, but at a core level, it's the same. So what makes somebody at risk for this? Teenagers and adults who have not been able to meet important needs in their real world turn to a virtual world to meet those needs. Socially awkward or anxious young folks are particularly susceptible to this. They have poor social skills, like I said earlier. They feel or experience being ostracized by peers, picked on by peers. They might lack athletic ability. I've seen that a lot. Not very good physically at a lot of sports, or a lot of physical activities. So I'm going to do something where my brain is the only organ that I really have to use. Overall psychological immaturity makes sense. And it stays like any addiction. We talk about it being stagnant, right? Somebody that gets involved in habitual escapism, self-medication, stops growing psychologically. So what they talk about in addiction circles, if you start using substances habitually at the age of 16 and you stop when you're 30, you essentially have the maturity of a 17-year-old. Your development is arrested, it's fixed at that point, and then you pick up from there because you've been avoiding, escaping from, medicating for all the uncomfortable feelings that cause us all to grow. Low confidence, of course, low self-esteem, quirky, perhaps on the spectrum, the autism spectrum. Lack of success in school can be a predictor. I've seen it where it's not. I've seen very bright students, previously successful, find their way into online gaming addictions. And again, I'm talking about primarily online gaming addictions, but it's really a continuum. I talk about this all the time. We think about mental health as a binary, right? You're either mentally ill or you're mentally healthy. And while there are some lines that distinguish whether or not you meet the clinical criteria for a certain diagnosis, it's really a continuum that we all are on somewhere. And so again, we can do our own inventory, right? Like I shared earlier, Alex and I discussing it before you all joined us tonight, that idea that I can use my phone, I can use my internet activity to escape and to not feel. That ought not to necessarily, I want to make this point very clear because it's the same with virtually every symptom that leads a parent to be concerned to send their child to a VOC. It doesn't need to, and I'll talk about this at the end, the kind of take-home parenting concept. It doesn't need to prevent you from intervening. right? If you're struggling with something at one level and your child is struggling with that same thing, you're still allowed to intervene. You don't have to get sober to, or stop drinking to intervene with your child. Now, if you have a drinking problem, that on its own means that there's benefit in you getting sober. But I think a lot of parents sometimes hold themselves hostage, like, I can't do it because I'm not perfect in that area. Parents will ask me all the time, do I need to stop drinking? Do I need to, the same question could be asked, do I need to stop doing certain things with my electronics in order to hold my child accountable or to intervene? And the answer is no, you don't. You stop drinking if it's a problem. You work on your own computer interface if it's a problem. But you don't have to be perfect. Back to the topic of lack of success in school. Learning differences, having a nonverbal learning disability or ADHD can be something that creates a vulnerability for addiction to online gaming and online activity. Executive functioning deficits, stress tolerance problems. Oftentimes we see these kids, especially in the wilderness. In wilderness, I'm going to talk about this. Wilderness really is, in my estimation, the optimal intervention for these types of kids. We see them as particularly lacking an ability to deal with frustration, tolerance, delay of gratification, stress. Emotional difficulties that come from it, like I talked about, emotional regulation, very easy to escalate, like all addictions. Depression, anxiety, mood disorders, not able to manage stress, difficulties with transition and changes, right? Some countries, this is a picture of Korea. They did this in Korea. Some countries have created boot camps to treat online addictions. It's not just in the United States. And speaking of support groups and 12 steps and recovery, Online Gamers Anonymous, or OLGA, is a 12-step program for recovery from video game addiction. OLGA was founded by Liz Woolley in 2002 after her son, Sean Woolley, committed suicide while logged into EverQuest, one of the earliest multiplayer online role-playing games. This U.S.-based group, Online Gamers Anonymous, opened its first chapter where they have face-to-face meetings in Canada. Brad Dorrance was a founding member of this chapter in London, Ontario, and he came to this group after his 12-hour-a-day habit contributed to the breakup of his marriage and led to an attempted suicide. So again, just like codependency, we talk about codependency as kind of this supporting a peripheral issue with addiction. Codependency can be deadly. Codependency can create situations where you put yourself in a situation that is at great risk to your physical health and can lead to depression and other issues that could lead to suicide. So we think about, I think the big ticket, the ones that are obvious, like those earlier pictures that I showed you, where the guy's snorting cocaine, that's what we think the face of addiction is. But it can be these more subtle forms. And Doran said, I think people need to see how much damage can be done in relationship to addiction, even this one. So again, it's a self-serving message, but I strongly believe it to be true that wilderness therapy is the ideal form of therapy. You have in vivo, real-time live social skills training, a high level of staff involvement to intervene continually if necessary, right? You're learning, it becomes this microcosm for your life, for peer relationships, for family relationships. And staff are modeling and coaching and creating structure around how you problem solve and communicate frustration with each other. You learn effective ways to deal with real three-dimensional people, complex people. Improved confidence is one of the outcomes, of course. Decreasing in social anxiety is another outcome. And increasing in empathy and social reciprocity. I have some pictures for those of you that are watching the video version of this. There's some nice pictures here. This first one is of a child doing a bow drill fire. We call it busting a fire. And so in wilderness therapy, you have an opportunity to master challenging new skills and increase confidence. Increasing self-efficacy has been one of the things that's been identified in wilderness therapy to improve for many years, for over 25 years. The research has shown that. That when you accomplish something difficult and have a sense of self-efficacy, that is, that my effort makes a difference. It makes a big difference. Learn to problem solve with others. There's a picture here of children walking across a stream with a staff. A place for contemplation, introspection, mindfulness, right? I think wilderness therapy is a place to spend time with yourself and see how you like the company, a place to feel your feelings, a place to be mindful. There's very little to out there to stimulate you or allow you an easy escape from feelings and from what's going on in the here and now. Of course, exercise. The lack of screen time is inherent. I said this when I started working in wilderness therapy 23 years ago. It's so obvious to me now. And when I hear people talk today about wilderness therapy, about it being on the cutting edge or not mainstream, I'm thinking it's the most obvious model in the world these days. I would imagine most of us could benefit from being unplugged for some time. I read a quote recently that said, being offline is the new luxury, right? We crave at times to be places where we don't have access to a cell phone and to the internet. When we run our intensives, our Finding You intensives and our Finding Family intensives, we ask everybody to unplug. Unless there's an emergency, we say put away all devices for the entire time. And most people embrace it. Some people struggle with it, but most people embrace it. And that really is one of the best things about it. So lack of screen time, getting some real exercise makes a big difference. Eating healthy food, you know, these are the three inherent things in wilderness therapy. I met a psychiatrist in New York City who said that that's all they did in a study that he conducted with their young people, young adults, just to see how that impacted mood disorders, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and just changing diet, getting exercise, and getting good sleep made all, and reducing screen time, just those things made a big difference. You develop a real sense of belonging, right? A sense of connectedness. Here's some children playing tag out there, and they're learning what it means to have fun physically, to get along. We try to change up the games because people that might not have a physical capacity in some area, we want to give them as many options as possible. And experiencing beauty of the real world. You know, getting to see nature. And then experiencing real magic. I have a picture up here of a bird drinking water out of one of the children's shoes. Some of the stuff is really beautiful and really simple. Here's kind of a summary of the parenting interaction, the parenting principle for this. As with other addictions, it's not your job to discover if your child is an addict or to diagnose them. It is your job to set healthy boundaries in your life, in your home, and in your relationship with your child. It comes down to the axiom, this is what I feel comfortable with. I may be wrong or old-fashioned, but this is my limit. Most parents of children that are struggling with substance abuse disorders or other kinds of behaviors try to discover if their child meets that clinical criteria. If they cross that threshold where they're diagnosable, right? That I think that gives the parents a sense of empowerment, justification maybe, permission to set boundaries. And what we know in parenting work and in treating these kinds of disorders is that thinking is really a limitation. It's the opposite that one learns when one goes into treatment for codependency, for being somebody who's in a relationship with people who have addictive and compulsive disorders, other mental health disorders. You learn to not be right, but rather you learn to be a self and to assert that self in your life, in your home, and in your relationships. Other takes home that, like I said, wilderness therapy is an ideal intervention for these kinds of things, internet and computer addiction. It gets at the core issues that place the individuals at risk, and that not only, it's like a lot of things. It's like substance abuse disorder. The things that make one vulnerable to it are actually damaged by the substance abuse disorder and exacerbated by the substance abuse disorder. So you start it because of some of the problems that you have, and then the substance abuse disorder actually makes those problems worse. It helps build coping skills. This intervention helps build coping skills and capabilities, helps build social skills and confidence, helps with the anxiety and the depressive issues. It gives kids hope for a real life. It's great for kids that haven't yet retreated into a virtual world, but who aren't functioning well in the real one because of the reasons discussed today. So again, when I sent him to wilderness 11 years ago, 12 years ago, he probably didn't meet the threshold that a lot of the clients that I've seen over the years have met. But I knew it was as helpful and preventative at getting us off the path that we were headed down as it was reparative. I didn't need for it to get to fully blossom, to intervene. Clients who have histories of depression, anxiety, social maladjustment, academic problems, and learning differences are susceptible to this kinds of thing, this kind of behavior, this kind of obsession. All right, I'm happy to take any live questions. My son spent 8 weeks at Evoke last spring. He turned 18 and has gone back into serious gaming. He won't admit that it's a problem, and now he refuses treatment, and we don't know what to do. Again, it's not an answer specifically about what to do. You can express love, patience, and empathy. But like this quote that I read two slides ago, it really isn't your job to diagnose him. It's your job to set boundaries about what you're comfortable with. I talk about, like, are you willing? When I think about enabling or rescuing, I think about the idea of, are you willing to participate in funding the experiment? You know, when a child goes out there and says, I'm going to use again, I don't think I'm an addict. Or I'm going to get back into gaming, I don't think I have a problem. You get to decide if you're comfortable funding that project, that experiment, or not. That's your circle. That's your side of the street. That's your lane. And then as you do that, you express love. You express concern clearly, but not repetitively. You're not nagging. You're not asking. You're not kind of trying to control him. You're setting very clear boundaries about what you're comfortable participating in. If it's leading to problems, you may not want him to live with you. If it's leading to conflict, you may not want him to be in the house if he's 18, just as you would think about it with a drug addict. I can't watch this. I can't have this in my home. It's not healthy for me. It's not good for my recovery. So it's not easy, but be clear about what your side of the street is and what it's not. You can't, remember, I'll say this because this goes with all of our children. And this is counterintuitive. This is not about fixing your kids. Your kids heal in this process. But it's about you. And eventually you will learn. When you get away from, if you happen to fall in with these psychologists, therapists that are formulaic that tell you if you follow these steps closely enough, your child will get better. We know that to be an insane thought process and really just feeds into the same kind of thinking and formula that got parents into this dynamic with their children. You can only do what you can do. That's what the work of treating codependency has taught us. When you're dealing with chronically struggling children with mental health and addiction issues, you don't try to fix them. You try to set healthy boundaries. And by the way, you can intervene when they're under 18, and you can set boundaries that can lead to an intervention when they turn 18. I'm not talking about a passivity. That's the biggest misunderstanding that comes when I teach about this, is that it suggests, people hear me suggesting you don't do anything. You do more, and you do it more clearly, courageously, honestly, and cleanly. So my answer would be the same as if your son had a substance abuse disorder, which is get in treatment for your codependency, which is just a kind of a self-help term for getting clear about your boundaries, about yourself, and about your relationship with your child. Next question, do you talk to the students at Evoke about the similarities between game addiction and substance abuse addiction? And how do you, yes, we do it with everything. You know, again, there's some children that are here for substance abuse disorder, some that have never used substances, and it's innate. You know, I say this all the time, that after students have been here a handful of weeks, they will do it themselves. It's all the time. They'll say, that's not my drug of choice. My drug of choice is anger or cutting or sleeping or food, right? So yes, it's always talked about in that way. It's always, 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 always we go a few layers deep. The symptom is the trail of crumbs, as I say it, that you follow to find the wound, the dilemma, the real issue. So it's just consistent all the time. We do it, they do it. It's obvious because you're sitting around a group with 6 to 10 clients who have different stories. And if they pay too much attention to the differences in those stories, they'll think that they're terminally unique. And of course they're not even from us. When you talk about setting boundaries, one parent asks, what do you do when your child is 18 and doesn't comply with your boundary? You enforce it. You know, a boundary isn't to get somebody else to change. A boundary is to take care of yourself. So in the case of an 18-year-old, I guess if they don't support your boundary, they don't get to live there, right? I mean, that's the end game. There are smaller steps along the way, but I'd ask the same question. If your spouse was physically abusive to you, or if your spouse was an alcoholic and you set a boundary that, I mean, they're way over 18, and you set a boundary that says, I can't have this in my home, and they don't respect it, you follow through with it. Or not, right? Like, I don't tell you when to leave or when to kick them out. That's not my job. I don't think that's any therapist's job. But we do talk about boundaries, about why you struggle with them and what they look like. And if you're not ready to draw that line in the sand and say, if you do this, then you can't live here, then don't say that. We don't talk about boundaries to threaten. The spouse that leaves, the alcoholic spouse, doesn't say, I'm going to divorce you or leave to get the other spouse to stop drinking. I want to be clear about that. The sober spouse does not say to the alcoholic spouse, I'm going to leave if you keep drinking, to get them to stop drinking. Sometimes that happens, and oftentimes it doesn't. The reason that the spouse says that is because they're being clear with their intentions and their boundaries, and if they end up leaving, they don't leave to get their spouse to stop drinking. They leave to set a boundary. Now, ironically, this is a tricky one because it can be a trapping for you. This kind of thinking does tend to contribute to dynamics and relationships that have the outcomes that we want. But if we're just playing a mind game and trying to fool ourselves by saying, I'm going to set this boundary, I'm just setting it for me, but in the back of our mind, we think this is really going to change the child. It doesn't. And I'll say it very emphatically one more time. You cannot fix your child. You can only fix you. And you can only make a positive contribution and a more optimal, more ideal contribution to your child. But it's the thinking that we can fix or control somebody else that is the problem. And people that let go of that actually show up more courageous, more honest, more clear, more capable with boundaries. And they tend to. Oh, my child is under 18, the parent asks, not over 18. What are my options? It's a little bit more challenging in those ways. So again, Evoke is an option for some people, right? You can escalate it. Like if we have to talk about the nuclear option, it's still kicking him out of the house. It's still sending him to Evoke, right? It's still doing other things. But I only get to that point because it's extreme. You know, they can go live with somebody else, right? You can call the police. I've had many parents call the police on their children under the age of 18 over the years. Many, many. For drugs, for violence, for other things. That's not an uncommon thing. But short of those nuclear options, go to therapy. You, go to therapy. If they won't come, go by yourself. ideally invite them to come to help you. Go to Al-Anon, go to CODA. Learn what it's like to be in a situation where you think you're powerless because it feels that way. And learn what it means to take back your power. And so it's really a different kind of sensibility. So it's no quick answer to the scenario of what do I do if my child is under 18 and they don't respect my boundaries? It's a way of being with them. And the nuclear options can be executed at some point, calling the police, kicking them out, putting them in a treatment program if you can afford it, letting them live with a relative, so forth and so on. But there's a lot therapeutically, psychologically, sensibility that we ask you to do ahead of time. Really, even though none of my children are struggling profoundly right now to the level that they need treatment, that's still what I work on every day. Is how do, because I have clients and I have a wife and I have children that struggle at varying levels at times. So I'm always trying to learn, what do I do when somebody in my life that I care about is being unkind or cruel, violating my boundaries, not living in accordance with, in my home or in my life, with what I need, with my values, what do I do with it? That becomes the question. And it's the question that I'll keep asking in my own therapy session till the day that I die, right? How do I exist in this world with people that I care about and am related to and interacting with who are struggling and who seek to violate boundaries and are doing self-destructive things? So learning that lesson is probably the important thing. Then the decisions about what you decide to do come out of that. But if I just give answers about what you do, that's not the solution. Because I've seen people kick their kids out of the house and the kids have ended up dead. And I've seen parents not kick their kids out of their house and their kids have ended up dead. And I've seen vice versa. I've seen parents take a pretty soft approach and their kids have ended up okay, and parents not take a pretty hard approach and their children have ended up okay. So it's not the doing thing. This is what my book is all about. It's not what you do that determines whether or not you're successful. First of all, some of it is the child's period and it's not yours. But it is how you think about, how you're relating to it, your sensibility. And if you do it out of fear and control of outcomes, you can never do it right. And if you do it out of courage and authenticity and healthy self-awareness and care, you can almost never do it wrong. My daughter is currently at Evoke. Thank you for what you're doing. I love doing this. You're welcome. Thank you for joining. Thank all of you for joining. It's a good group tonight. My Alex asked me, he thought the size of the group that we were receiving, he was thinking, I wonder if everybody thinks this is about them because so many of us know to some extent that we spend too much time in front of a screen. All right. We want you, and I've mentioned this already, this is a free service. We want you all to attend 6 12-step support groups while your child is with us, ideally. But if you haven't started now and your child's leaving or has left, do it now. Just attend 6, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous. You can also go to NAMI.org and find out about free resources and classes in your area. Follow us on social media on the podcast app on your iOS, your iPhone device. Search Evoke Therapy Programs. Also, download the SoundCloud app on Android devices and search Evoke Therapy Programs, or go to SoundCloud.com on any computer and search Evoke Therapy Programs. Twitter and Instagram, follow us at Evoke Therapy. Facebook, at Evoke Therapy. I just thought of the irony of me talking about social media when I've been talking about social media and the negative sides. You know, this is a lot of our resources too, right? There's an upside to social media and all these things, inspiring content. You can find the Family Foundation on Facebook. You can also go to our blog. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is available on Amazon. The next workshop for parents, if you are a current parent, we would like all parents who can possibly come to go to a workshop while their child is with us. You can combine that with a field visit if your therapist thinks it's appropriate. Your child's therapist thinks it's appropriate. The next one is going to be in our Cascades location, December 8th and 9th. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information. If you want to attend one of our intensives, that's in a lodge, a very comfortable and cozy lodge, come to one of our intensives for yourself. We have some alternative ones coming up. We have a Finding You that's specific for alumni parents, January 9th through 13th. We have a Finding You for wilderness students. This is any student who is now 18. They could have been under 18 when they came with us, but if they're over 18 now, we have developed a Finding You program for wilderness alumni. That's January 20th through 24th. I'm running both of those, by the way. And then our Finding You will be in February. Our next Finding You generally will be in February 20th through 24th. And then contact the intensives at evoketherapy.com for more information. We also do private family intensives, as few as two people for those. Parent support groups coming up. I'll be in the Bay Area December 11th, in Los Angeles January 6th, and in New York on January 14th. Email melanie@evoketherapy.com for more information or to RSVP. Pursuit trips are outdoor trips anywhere in the world, various lengths of time, customized for families or young adults. Okay. Any other questions or comments? No more questions or comments? Again, thank you for joining us. Next week, I'm going to be talking about how to raise an emotionally intelligent child, a book review on the book by John Gottman. So I look forward to that. Monday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, already December. Thank you, as always, for and on behalf of your children, for the commitment to show up to these sessions, to these broadcasts, if you're watching them live or if you're listening to them later. Thank you for what you're doing to help your family, to help your child, to contribute to your child in the dynamic in a more positive way. Have a great evening. Talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye. No turns back.